Thanks for coming tonight. So in your bulletins here, I want to start by just giving you an opportunity to sort of think through what we're going to talk about. You see, my title of my message is What Faith Looks Like, and we're going to look in Hebrews chapter 11 at what faith looked like to a whole bunch of amazing people and how faith worked in their life. But before we do that, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that's true is I mean, the word faith, it's almost impossible to spend any amount of time talking about your Christian life or Christian experience, whether it's with your children or your spouse or someone that isn't a Christian. It's almost impossible to talk about your Christian experience and not use that word. And so what I want to do here just real quick is in the top of your notes there, I gave you a blank space, and I want you to fill in as best you can. If you were going to define what that word means or looks like in your life, I want to give you a minute to do that. Now, if you don't have a pen or pencil with you, that's great, because I know everybody's got a mobile device, a smartphone or something that they can write this out. So you got no excuse not to be doing something, even if it's texting your boyfriend or girlfriend. Take out something, and I want to give you an opportunity just sort of reflect and think for a minute before we jump in. What does that word mean? What is it, you know, according to your own language and definition, something we talk about a lot, how would you define it? So I'll give you a minute to go ahead and do that. I can see some people took me up on the offer to text. Already done. Nice to have you come, Pat, a little late, but better late than never. When I used to come, this is just like high school for me. I used to come, I'd sit in the back.
This to you? What's your phone number?
You want my phone number? 530-545-0085. You're welcome to text it to me. All right, take another 30 seconds and finish up here. One of my unscientific observations is that people who sit closer to the front tend to take this more seriously than people in the back. People in the back, it was like, you know, when I was in high school, I sat in the back row. I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. It's the same thing in church. All three services have been like that, so... I think people are afraid that I'm going to call them out. I would never do that. Okay, so this week what I did is I was curious because I'm talking about faith from Hebrews chapter 11. I was curious, how do people define this? And so what I did is I took a sheet of paper just like this and I handed it out at our staff meeting and a couple other places this week with people in our church. And I was curious what their answers would be. And so I think I collected like 35 or 36 different responses. And one of the things that was really fascinating to me about this was as common as this word is in terms of our understanding of Christianity and our discussions about it, what was fascinating to me is not a single person had duplicate answers. Nobody said the exact same thing, which tells me that as important as the word faith is and the idea is of faith in our lives as Christians, we don't have like a single specific agreed upon working definition for it. Isn't that fascinating to think about? But that doesn't mean that there aren't some commonalities that stuck out. And so some of these things that probably some of you wrote, how many of that top one, it says a complete trust, and they use the word confidence there. I highlighted that. Anybody in here write down on their thing? Anybody use the confidence or complete trust? Anybody put that down? A couple people. The second one, this is the most common thing that people wrote, and it was interesting because they wrote it, they wrote these two words together in this order. People said believing and trusting in something or in God. Anybody write down believing and trusting? Anybody have that? A couple people? Most of you had something totally different. It's okay. Just backs up what I was saying, that we don't have a common way of thinking about this. So the thing that I want to point out to you today, that the problem with most of our definitions of the word faith as we tend to use it, and this was true of all the people that I collected information from, is people primarily think of it as as something that is true in their head, something that they're convinced of, information that they believe deeply, but very, very, very few people. In fact, only three people said this on the information that I got, that said that whatever they came to trust, believe, have confidence in, led to some sort of direct action. And one of the things that you're going to find today as we go through this is it's difficult to use that word apart from it being demonstrated in your life as action. Because the best way to think about the word faith as it's used in the New Testament in almost every place is not just a bunch of information that you believe really, really strongly, but it's information that you believe really strongly, or maybe you don't believe all that strongly, but you are willing to act on it. That your life is, you have made a determination that I am going to be faithful to what God asked me to do. My faith is represented by my faithfulness, my willingness to move in the direction that God asks me to go. So a way to think about this, a good working definition from Hebrews chapter 11, this is on the back of your notes in your bulletin, is this. It says, we can define faith as the action, because it's almost impossible to divorce that word faith from faithfulness, from action, of ordinary people. And this, that again, that word ordinary people is really important, because one of the things people all the time they'll do when they start reading Hebrews chapter 11 is they go, these were magnificent people, and these were really special people. So, of course, God's going to hold them up as great examples. And one of the things that we immediately do in thinking that is we divorce ourselves going, I'm just an ordinary person. Those people were extraordinary. And so it's no wonder that God use them and their faith in spectacular ways in their lives and in the world. And one of the things that's so important to understand is if you took the time to actually go through and read the examples of each of these people, one of the things you're going to find out is none of these people distinguished themselves before God ever came to them. These people were ordinary people for the most part. And so in that sense, this idea of faith doesn't have anything to do with just being something that is for extraordinary, special people. Faithfulness ought to be demonstrated in the lives of every ordinary person who claims to follow Jesus or to love God. So it's the action of ordinary people based on their confidence in God's, what are they putting their confidence in? In His promises, in His Word. And the result of it has various earthly outcomes. That's important too, because sometimes we think that our faith, and when we act faithfully towards God, that means that everything is going to go really well for us. And one of the things you're going to find out is in this life, you're not guaranteed comfort, security, wealth, and health. Just because you are faithful, no matter how faithful you are to God, there is no guarantee that everything is going to go well for you and that life is going to be super comfortable for you. But that shouldn't diminish our sense of responsibility to be faithful to God. But whatever the results were, we can be sure that it's the only way to gain God's commendation. And it's the only way that we're going to enter into that future rest and promise that He offers us. And you'll see as we read through this that's made really clear here. So I want you to think about this in practical terms, because a lot of people have a hard time thinking about faith apart from non-religious context. But I want to show you just in three quick examples that faith shapes your everyday lives in a ton of ways. And everybody understands how important faith is. And the first one is in terms of relationships. Everybody understands how important it is to be faithful to the promises that you make to someone. And everybody understands this, because when you find out that someone hasn't been faithful, whether it's a spouse or a child, what happens? It becomes difficult to trust them. And that expectation that you have of them is greatly diminished, right? So we understand that faith is important, because no relationship is secure or is of great value to us unless there is some degree of faithfulness demonstrated in it, right? Another way to think about it is when you drive. Most of you who came here tonight, you went through a stoplight on your way here. And this is sort of like the common way that we experience faith and how it shapes our common existence in life, which is when you go through a stoplight, if it's green, as you're approaching it, you don't stop and wonder, oh my gosh, I hope the other people recognize that it's red. You don't do that. You don't slow down as you approach a green light, do you? And you have trust, confidence, faith that other people are going to be acting the same consistent way you are based on whatever information they see in front of them. Now, the reason this is an important illustration is because your ability to trust something doesn't always require that you completely understand how it works. How many of you know the science about how lights, stoplights, are wired? But does anybody in here, because you don't know that science behind them, does anybody in here stop and go, wait a minute, I don't know that because I don't know how this thing works, I don't know that I can trust it. I'm driving home from church today, and I'm going across this bridge over here on Black Bart. And I thought, you know what? I mean, this is like when I cross that bridge, I've crossed it a bunch of times, but all of a sudden I don't stop and go, there's been a lot of water running under this thing. I wonder if it's going to hold up my car today, right? What I should have done, right, was stop my car, got off, gone and looked underneath, looked at that, has it been eroded? Are the supports good? Who is the engineer that actually engineered this? And what's their track record? See, implicitly, there's tons of opportunities every day for us to exercise faith that we do that we don't even think about, even if we don't understand how things work. And see, this is important because one of the things that people will do is they'll say, I don't know if I can trust God. Why? Because they don't understand what God is doing. You go through stoplights. Your life operates all the time on your inability to understand how everything works, and that doesn't stop you from acting in faith, does it? So it's kind of crazy that we'd get to God and go, how can I trust God when I don't know what he's doing or where he's leading me or how this is going to work out, right? We ought to apply that same sort of generosity that we experience every day in our life. And the last one is one of the really key things to understand about faith is this. You know, your amount of faith, great or small, doesn't determine the outcome when it comes to whether God is going to fulfill his promise. Because ultimately, it doesn't. The outcome of your acting in faith, moving towards God, doesn't matter whether you really believe God is going to do it or sort of believe God is going to do it. See, think about this in terms of gravity. Does it matter whether you think gravity is going to work well today or not? Is the force and the effect of gravity and the effect it has on your life, does it depend on whether you really believe it's going to work today or have a small amount of belief that it's going to work today? Absolutely not, because what really matters is the object of your faith consistent and trustworthy? Of course it is. And this is important, and I'll tell you why this was such an important mystery for me to get my mind around a couple years ago. I had a really hard time understanding how I knew people as Christians. You know, they never went to Bible college. They never went to Sunday school as kids. They didn't know the Bible anywhere near as well as I did. They couldn't recite the Bible book from the beginning to the end. They didn't know the children's songs. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible. They didn't know that stuff. They didn't understand anything about theology and about how God works. And yet the crazy thing is I saw in their lives over and over again that there were people that chose to trust God and act obediently. And I go, wait a minute, you don't understand theology about why God is doing what he's doing or why he's asking you to do. What do you mean you're not going to engage in premarital sex? Do you understand why God doesn't want you to do that? They go, no, but God tells me not to do it, so I'm not going to do it. I go, wait a minute. You better know why he's asking you to do that if you're going to set your passions aside, right? It's crazy to think that you wouldn't do that. But you know what? Here's the thing that I came to find out is that whether you really, no matter how much you know about God, no matter how much you know the right information and the right theology, that doesn't always determine that you're willing to act faithfully towards him. And that's what God asks of us, ultimately. It's not about knowing all of the right answers. It's not even about understanding what God is always doing in the world. God asks the same thing of every one of us, whether you understand it or not. He asks us to move from where we are towards where he asks us to go. Because he says, I, God, know what's better for you and the world and your future than you do, whether you get it or not. And that's the key thing about faith. faithfulness shouldn't depend on whether you really get it or not. It's ultimately your willingness to move forward ought to rest securely knowing that the object of your faith is completely trustworthy, right? So let's read through Hebrews here, and I'll stop a couple of times in there. You can see in your notes to deal with a couple of sort of misconceptions and pitfalls that people have. One of the things that's important is people love this chapter. It's one of the greatest chapters in the entire Bible, but it's important to put it in the context of all the things that Hebrews teaches us. And leading up to this, there's four sections. In each one of those sections, the author is saying, he says exactly what I just said. He said, all of the Old Testament ways that God revealed himself, they're great and they're wonderful. But ultimately, the greatest source of authority that God has revealed himself in is in his Son, Jesus. And he's completely worthy to put all of your faith and all of your trust into. And you ought to listen and obey him. And one of the things that each one of those sections closes with is a really stern warning, saying it does matter whether you do act faithfully towards Jesus or not. And so like, here's the last warning in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26. It says, if we deliberately keep on sinning after we've received knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sin is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. That's serious, isn't it? See, the author says this isn't playtime. This isn't like, this would be nice. This isn't just like a friendly recommendation. He's saying it really matters whether you put your trust and your faith in God for your ultimate security. Because if you don't, just like there's amazing benefits to doing it, there's serious consequences if you don't do it. So the author knows these people. And he knows that these people are going through incredible difficulty. These people have been, they've lost their jobs and their possessions. They've been thrown in jail. Some of their friends have lost their life because they're Christians. And so he understands why people are hesitant to continue to walk towards God, continue to be faithful. So he encourages them because he's seen this faith. And so in verse 35, he says, so don't throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. Persevere. Hang in there is what the author says. And then in verse 1 of chapter 11, he goes through and he's going to give them this exhortation. It's one of the highest points of the entire scripture. It's this amazing view of people that have trusted God and been willing to be faithful. And so he says, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we don't see. This is what the ancients were commended for. These people were faithful people, and they were commended for that faith. Verse 3 says, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was made out of what is not visible. And this is the first place I'll stop here for you, and I just want to, this is the longest thing I want to take a break before we keep reading, just to go through with you, because one of the things that people say, this answers that question about first cause. Where did everything come from? Where did the galaxies, universe, life, world, where did it all come from? And one of the things that a lot of people will say is they'll say that this is their main objection to the whole Christianity thing, is they say that your faith is a blind leap to believe that God is responsible for all of this stuff. Or they would say this, and when they use the word blind, what they're really saying is that there's absolutely no real rationale for you trusting God, that you ought to put your faith in him, and that you ought to move towards God in faithfulness. Mike, I'm just getting started. Where are you going, buddy? Are you crying? You need tissue. Have I made you sad already? And so here's the thing. A couple years ago, we talked about how you can look out into space and you can see the grandeur of what God has made. He's put his amazing handiwork on display for all of us. And if, look, besides what you see out in the universe, and let's say you don't think that God was responsible for creating that, here's something to consider. Forget whether you attribute that to God or not. If you read the Bible, do you understand that there's no, you know, Nostradamus, however you say the guy's name, you know? I mean, there's no book that has been accurate in predicting the future, the prophecies, like the Bible has. I mean, if you want proof whether or not the book of the Bible is worth putting your whether it's a valid book, just consider whether or not all the prophecies that have been fulfilled are worth saying this is a valid book. Just that special, specific revelation that God gave. Forget looking out into the universe. But see, here's the thing, and this is what you all ought to consider when you look out into the universe, into the galaxies. And Eric Metaxas wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal a couple years ago. He says, today there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met, or the whole thing falls apart. Without a massive planet like Jupiter nearby, whose gravity will draw away asteroids, 1,000 times as many would hit Earth's surface. The odds against life in the universe are simply astonishing. And he goes on to say, he says, yet here we are not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for all of it? Can every one of those many parameters have been perfect by accident? Is it a blind faith to believe that all of that stuff just happened to work out well for us? At what point is it fair to admit that science suggests that we can't be the results of random forces? Doesn't assuming that an intelligence created these perfect conditions require far less faith than believing that a life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds to come into being? So and I'll grant you, this guy, he's not a scientist, right? But it's a nice argument that he makes, right? But think about what the scientists do say about this. I'm not a mathematician, and Hugh Ross is both a mathematician and astronomer. This is what he says. Much less than one chance in a million trillionth, that's a big number, exists that even one such planet would occur anywhere in the universe. Right? And a guy who was a Nobel laureate, he says this. He says, astronomy leads us to a universe with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say what? Supernatural. This isn't Eric Metaxas, a guy who is primarily a guy who argues about Christianity. These are what scientists say. This is really what the evidence suggests and supports, right? This guy, if there's anybody that ever looked like a scientist, it's this guy, right? Now, this guy, here's what you need to really appreciate about this guy. This guy started out as a naturalist, as an atheist, who was a big advocate of our Darwinian naturalism, natural selection. And as he went along in his career, the more and more he became convinced, not based on what other people told him, but just on the evidence of what he examined to be true. And he went from being a naturalist, saying this just happened by blind, random forces, to saying, you know what, that's crazy. And he didn't become a Christian, but he certainly became a theist. And that's what he says. Common sense, right? Interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics as well as the chemistry and biology to explain what we see about life in the universe and the world today. Discovery Magazine, which is absolutely no friend of creation science, says this. I mean, look, when they're honest about this, and they've said this sort of thing a number of times, they're not willing to say out and out that they believe in intelligent design, but they understand this when they look at the evidence. They say the universe is unlikely, very unlikely, deeply, shockingly unlikely. It's quite fantastic. They're not willing to say it's a miracle, but they get that it really is a miracle. And finally, it's Francis Crick, who's responsible for being on the team who helped map DNA originally and explain DNA and how it worked. And he was a doctor, and he had a couple of different specialties and was responsible for winning the Nobel Prize twice. But he said this. He says, an honest man armed with the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment, I like how he puts all these qualifiers to that, at the moment, to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions in which would have had to be satisfied to get it all going. Look, when people say to you that your faith, that being faithful to God or putting your life in action and confidence based on Him and His promises and His word is crazy, just take a minute and reflect and remind them of what science actually tells us about whether or not there's a God or not. That really explains how everything got here that we understand about the material universe. And more than that, that explains something that is as miraculous as anybody who understands cellular biology understands. That random forces cannot be responsible for your biology and what's come to exist in your body today. And the human eye is just one of so many different examples of this, right? The tiny retina contains about 130 million rod-shaped cells, which detect light and intensity and transmit impulses to the visual cortex of the brain by means of some 1 million nerve fibers, while nearly 6 million cone-shaped cells do the same job but respond specifically to color variation. The eyes can handle 500,000 messages simultaneously and are cut clear by ducts, producing just the right amount of fluid with which the lids can both clean the eyes simultaneously in 1/5,000th of a second. And you want me to believe that all of this happened naturally, blindly? I say to you, if you want to talk about a blind faith and a leap of faith, naturalism is the blind faith. And it is the bigger leap than actually believing that there was some God that actually knew what he was doing and created life to be the way it is. And I want to tell you why this absolutely matters, and it should matter to every human being alive today. One of the greatest theologians I've ever met actually helped me with my sermon. So my daughter, she recognized I was having a hard time with one of my messages. So I come home, and she had stapled together a sermon for me. She's 8 now. I don't know how old she was when she did this, but this is what she says. This was the last page of her sermon that she wrote. She gets her spelling from her dad, obviously. Right? What does she say? God's creation. It's amazing. Now, I want to tell you why this is absolutely the best theological advice you're ever going to get here tonight from me, which is this. See, if you're a naturalist and you believe in natural selection and blind random forces explaining life today, I don't have any reason to respect you as a human being. There's no moral basis for which I can say that I have to treat you well or be nice to you or kind to you at all. Because we're just an accident. Let's just be honest about that. Naturalism, Darwinian naturalism, gives us no moral meaning in life at all except for what you choose in your own mind and thought to believe is true or rational. But if my daughter isn't just the process of blind biological natural selection, but was made in God's image and his likeness, and he was knit together as his beautiful and amazing creation, just like every single one of you are, with intent and purpose, you better believe that I better respect you. And you better believe that what God says about morality and why life matters and why I treat you with dignity and respect absolutely matters. Right? And you think about the issue of abortion. Why would the issue of abortion matter if we are just a blob of cells? It wouldn't matter. But if you believe that what God knits together and puts together is his handiwork, it changes the way you treat every person who is living. And if you believe God is responsible for the environment, everything in it, who ought to be the very best environmentalists in the world today? It ought to be Christians. We ought to be the people that are most concerned with taking care of the good thing that God has given us, right? If we really believe it was a gift and displays his beauty and his grandeur, we ought to take care of it. By faith, and this is offered 24 times in here, by faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke about his offspring. And by faith, he still speaks even though he's dead. Hebrews makes these astounding statements like that. He's dead, but he's still alive because of his faithfulness to God. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he didn't experience death. He couldn't be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, without your faithfulness, it's impossible to please God. Because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Man, is that good news or what? One of my favorite Bible characters in the entire Bible is talked about in verse 7. It says, by faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, he built an ark to save his family. And by his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. And one of the greatest characters in the Old Testament is this guy named Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place that would later become his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. He was willing to get up and move, even though he didn't know where God was sending him. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were their heirs with him at the same promise. For he was looking forward to a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. He was looking forward to a promised land that God was sending them to, but he was really looking forward to a real promised land, ultimately. And that's what moved him. See, this guy, he's near retirement age, and God says, get up like a travel agent, and I've got a better place for you to go. Wait a minute, God, I'm just ready to settle down here. He's an old man at this point in his life. There was no Google Maps for him to follow. And he didn't have the internet to be able to look at the pictures and go, hey, this looks like a pretty good deal. I guess I'll go. He said, I will trust you that you know better than I do what is good for my future and my family, and I'll move, right? That's what faith oftentimes looks like that. Faithfulness says, I don't know what you're doing, where you're sending me, how this is. I don't even know how this is going to work out, but I'll move, God. I'll move in the direction you're sending me. By faith, even though he was past his age in terms of having children, and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. He trusted God's promise. And so from one man, he as good as dead, came the descendants as numerous as the stars in the skies, as countless as sands on the seashore. He didn't have a child. God says to him, I want to make a great nation out of you. He's an old man. Now, if you're a husband and you're looking for a new opportunity to be able to encourage your wife to continue intimacy, this might be a good way. It worked for Abraham. He's an old man, but he said, hey, this is what God says we should do, right? All of these people were still living by faith when they died. Is that great news, right? Listen, all these people were still alive by faith when they died. They're dead physically, but their spirit, because of their faithfulness, they didn't really experience death. Only physical death. They didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. Because they recognized that wasn't their home. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have the opportunity to return to it. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them, and he'll do the same. That city waits for you and I, too, when we live by faith. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promise was about to sacrifice his one and only son. The author here, he's incredulous. He's crazy. Even though God had said to him, it's through your son, through your offspring, that will be reckoned these nations. Abraham reasoned that God could raise him from the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did just that. Now, I want to point out something to you that's really important when you think about the person of Abraham. This is another misconception about faith that a lot of people have. Abraham, if you read in the Old Testament, he does some amazing things. He puts his faith into action in some really profound ways. But don't ever think that Abraham was a perfect guy. In fact, you read a lot of dirt about this guy where he was an absolute bonehead and totally rejected living by faith. He was not perfect by any means. Don't ever deceive yourself and think that people of faith live perfectly by that faith all the time. That's just not the case. But one of the other things that's important is a lot of people, I think they're embarrassed when they go, I don't fully understand how all of this works. I have questions, and I think sometimes people are embarrassed because they have questions. And I want you to know that Abraham, when God comes to him in Genesis 12 and he makes this promise, years go by, and God comes back to him in Genesis 15, and he says, I'm going to do this. And Abraham, you can see him scratching his head. And this is exactly what he says. Oh, sovereign Lord, how can this happen? He says, look, you made the promise. You came and made the promise again, but I'm not sure how this is all going to work out. And God doesn't scold him because he's curious and he doesn't understand all of this stuff. See, to ask questions is not the issue. God's never ashamed of us. He's never embarrassed when you do have questions. What he does care about is whether you get all your questions answered or not, in the end, will you be faithful? Will you continue to walk based on the belief and knowledge that God really does know better than you? If you have trouble appreciating this, go and read the Psalms. David, who was this incredible guy, David, right and left in the Psalms, cries out to God, yells at God, angry with God, questions God, and God never says to him, hey, buddy, faithful people don't act like that. God's never put off. He's never ashamed when people ask difficult questions. What he is concerned about is ultimately whether you get your questions answered satisfactorily to your desire or not. Are you willing to obey? That's what God cares about. Am I really God? Will you really trust me that I know better than you do? So he goes on in here and he says, I'm going to skip down to verse 23, and it says, by faith, picking up another person in the Old Testament, by faith, Moses' parents hid him when he was 3 months old after he had been born because his parents saw that he was no ordinary child. They weren't afraid of what the king said. They were more afraid of God than they were the king. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of the Pharaoh's daughter. So he rejects privilege because he'd rather be identified with God and his purposes than riches in life. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded as disgrace for the sake of Christ as a greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger, and he persevered because he saw him who was invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. And this is your third thing about a misconception that a lot of people have, which is, see, as amazing as Moses was, remember Moses taking the people from Egypt out of slavery into the Promised Land, into Israel. You know that Moses actually never got there? He died on the mountain just before he got there. And you go, what's up with that, God? Right? But Moses, see, he implicitly understood that that's a great place and would have been a great place to live, but he really understood that there was a greater place waiting for him. And see, this is the reality of faith is it doesn't always, being a faithful person doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a good, comfortable life and that you're going to see all of God's good purposes worked out in your life here and now. It's really important to understand that. It goes on in verse 29 to say, by faith, people passed through the Red Sea on dry land, and the Egyptian tried to follow them, but they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute... Did I read that right? By faith, the prostitute... Is that what that says there? Isn't that interesting? By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And this is your fourth misconception that a lot of people have, which is that if you've got a checkered past, right, or if you have a history of a lack of faithfulness, that somehow you can't, right where you are, choose to receive and be a faithful person right where you are. See, every person in the Scripture, every one of these people that you read in here, none of them were perfect. None of them, they all had struggles. They all had disappointments. They all had seasons of their life where they walked the other way from God. But what God is interested in is every day you have the opportunity to turn and respond and act in faithfulness and start right where you are. See, God's promise of forgiveness and salvation that comes to us from Jesus isn't revoked because we blow it tomorrow and the next day and the next day. That offer of forgiveness, 1 John 1:9, which says if we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. And it doesn't say that only works one time. In fact, the Greek, it's not a passive thing. It's an active, ongoing thing. But it seems like God sort of knew that we would have a hard time always being faithful. And that's why this is so important to recognize that faith doesn't mean that somehow when you choose to believe that you get it all together and you're not going to have any issues. And God isn't afraid of prostitutes being named as his people or you, whoever you are, whatever your past is, whatever challenges you may face in the future. Verse 32, he says, and what more shall I say? Do I have time to talk about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Japheth, David, Samuel, and the prophets who thought faith... And through who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned into strength, and who became powerful in the battles and routed foreign enemies. Women received back their dead who were raised to life. Now, is that good news or what? And most of us love that part of faith. That's really cool to hear all that cool stuff. I wish it just stopped right there. I wish it didn't go on. But this is what it says. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeering, flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. And some were stoned. And that word stoned didn't mean that they smoked anything. It meant that they had rocks thrown at them until they were dead, dead, dead. People were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskin, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in the deserts and the mountains and in the caves and the holes of the ground. That doesn't sound like a great thing, does it? See, that beginning half of that faith stuff, that's cool. But this stuff, I don't want that part of being what faith is all about. And see, this is the last thing that I want to tell you about a misconception that people have. Some people think that faith is primarily, when you're a faithful person, that means that God is primarily interested and will give you health and wellness in your life. The more faith you have and the more you put that into practice, the better life is going to be for you. And that's not at all what that says there. See, it says that some of those things, some of these people, it didn't work out so well for them. And you know what it seems like? It seems like God is saying, I'm really not all that concerned ultimately with your physical well-being as much as I am your character and your willingness to trust me whatever life throws at you, whatever the circumstances are. Are you willing to continue to follow me and trust that I've got something better for you at the end of all of this? No matter how well it works out for you, good or bad. Most of you know my hearing is horrible and getting worse all the time. And so people say to me, and I really appreciate when people say this, they'll say, Noah, I'd love to pray for you and pray in faith that God will heal you and that he'll restore your hearing. I'm thankful that people are concerned about my hearing. But you know, honestly, you know what I'm tempted to tell people? If you want to pray for me, it'd be great if I get my hearing back, but if you want to pray for me, you want to spend time praying for me, would you pray in faith that I'll be a better husband? Would you pray in faith that I'll be a better father? See, if my hearing, if it goes away tomorrow completely, gone, finished, that'd be a bummer, wouldn't it? But I could still hear God, and I could still know what God wants from me. And I want to tell you, that's far more important than if my hearing is restored tomorrow, but I completely, God could make it so I could hear a pin drop in a haystack again. But just because my hearing is restored doesn't mean that I'm going to be any more obedient and that I will be a better father or a better husband, does it? See, ultimately, whether I get my hearing back or not, I really am far more concerned with whether or not I hear God's voice and respond to it and choose to live faithfully to him. And if you want to spend time praying for me, you want to spend time praying for each other, it's great to pray that somebody will get well again. It's great to pray that somebody will be delivered from their financial difficulties. But I want to encourage you to think maybe it's better use of your time to pray that people's life would be empowered, that they might respond faithfully to God, whether they get better, whether they get rich, whether they are relieved of all their debt or not. Because ultimately, God is more concerned with your faithfulness than your physical comforts. And that's one of the key things to understand about what God is asking here. So in all of this, the last two verses, it just says, they were commended for their faith, yet none of them received what was promised. God had planned something better, not just for them, but for us, so that only together with us they might be made perfect. So no matter who you are in here, I really believe that everybody in here, you can respond to faith in God with one of these three ways. Every single person, I think, falls into one of these three categories. And so the first one is, I really think that as we go through this, some people in here, they go, I think that I may have placed my trust and my confidence and my source of security and happiness and peace in life in something other than what God offers. And the first place that that's offered is what he offers us in restoring our relationship via the forgiveness that he offers through Jesus' death on the cross. And I'm convinced that in a church like this, that there are people that come to that conclusion. And if that's true of you, you know a great way for you to respond in faith today is to say, I recognize that I've never really put my confidence and built my life on the forgiveness that God offers me. And I've never really responded to say that I believe that Jesus is the trustworthy person for me to put my full confidence in, and I'm going to make a decision to follow him. And if that's you, if you come to find that that might be true of you in your life tonight, a great thing for you to do is just stop right where you are right now. You don't have to listen to anything else I say, and just confess that and say, you know what, God, I know that there's no magic words. Just tell God, you know, that's just true of me. And I believe that Jesus really did. The forgiveness that Jesus offers isn't just for other people, but I know that it's what I need in my life too, and that's what I want to build my life on, is the forgiveness you offer. And when Jesus says, Jesus doesn't say, believe in me. He doesn't just say, put all the information in your head. What Jesus says is, follow me. Make a commitment to say, I'm going to build my life on the forgiveness you offer, and I'm going to choose to respond by walking in faithfulness towards you. There's another group of people in here that I believe that they go, that's great, Noah, but I did that a long time ago. Notice at the bottom, I put some fill in the blanks. If you did that, fill in. I want you to, this is great news. It's the greatest thing you could, it's the greatest decision you could make today. And if that's true of you, share it with somebody who you know will appreciate it, that can celebrate with you and talk to you about what it looks like to follow Jesus well. There are people in here that say, I've done that, but the truth is, no, I'm still hungry to really, I come to church sometimes, and this is the primary place where I get fed, but I'm not really growing in my faith the way, my faithfulness, the way I know God expects me to, or that I could enjoy the way that God made life to be lived. And if that's true of you, one of the best things you can do is commit yourself to not starve yourself by just getting fed here once a week, but commit yourself to surrounding yourself by other people that have the same goal as you, that you can study and meet and talk with. And one of the great things is in our bulletin, we've got all sorts of opportunities to do this. And if none of those fit the bill, you can come talk to me and I'll help you find somebody or a place where you can meet with people that will help you make it a more regular practice in your life, where you can learn more, think more, be prodded, and have a greater appreciation for what it looks like for you to follow God in the way he intends for you to do daily. Now, inevitably, there are some of you that go, I made that commitment a long time ago. I go to church on Sunday, every Sunday, and I go to church, I go to this study and this study and this study, and I pray every morning. Interesting, because most of you would say, well, great, then you got it all together, and you don't need any help. There's no good way for you to respond to God in faith. And this last group of people, here's what I want to encourage you to consider, is that a couple years ago, I read a study that said that 80% of the chaos that happens in your life is due to one unresolved issue that you've never really taken care of. And I am convinced from the counseling that I do with people and meet with people regularly that really is true, that you can source most of the difficulty in your life back to one issue that is unresolved, that you've never really taken seriously, that you've never really confessed to God and actively worked on getting it together. And whether that's anger, whether that's an addiction, whether it's something with pornography, I mean, everybody, it's different for everybody. Everybody has something in their life that I think makes it difficult for them to manage and experience life the way God intended for them to experience it. And I think that the honest and best thing you can do is say, you know what, God's been good to me, I've learned a lot of good things, but you know what, I need to sit down with someone, I need to confess and be honest about this one thing that continually seems to have a hold on my life, and I know that it's inhibiting me from being able to enjoy the richness that God wants me to. Find someone that you know you can trust, that you can sit down with and confess that, and ask them to help you think about what it looks like to confess it to God regularly and grow and work through whatever that challenge is. One of the great things is on Tuesday nights, we have a group that meets here, and on Friday mornings called Overcomers. And a lot of people think that Overcomers is just for addicts or people who are alcoholics, but it's a group that meets just for anybody that finds that they have something in their life that makes it difficult for them to manage. And it's a great opportunity to get together with other people that really take that seriously, learning how to talk, confess, and pray and work together to trust God to help them through that. Hope that you guys enjoy the challenge and opportunity this week that God will give you to respond by being faithful to Him. Father, thanks for the opportunity. Your word is amazing, and I'm excited for Dan's message next week, sort of building on this idea of faith and ultimately what the object of our faith ought to be and what it looks like for us to pursue that well. Thanks for people's faithfulness here to our church. Thanks for the opportunities we have to respond to faith in you. And we're grateful ultimately for the work that your son Jesus did on the cross that makes it possible for us to find forgiveness and be able to enjoy a rich life with you. We're grateful for all this in Jesus' name. Amen.